From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I feel strongly that Iran's a danger. Nothing's changed in this NIE that says, okay, why don't we just stop worrying about it? Quite the contrary. I think the NIE makes it clear that Iran needs to be taken seriously as a threat to peace.
The national intelligence estimate is out. Iran shut down its nuclear weapons program 4 years ago. What did President Bush know, and when did he know it? Then an explosive report by Indian magazine Tehelka exposes who was responsible for the 2002 massacre of 2,500 Muslims in Gujarat.
What the Tehelka reporter managed to do was get from the horse's mouth exactly how these mass murderers killed, who they killed, how they killed, on whose orders they killed. And then, not just that, how the entire process of justice was subverted after the massacres were over, and how many of these men had then been protected by the state.
And anti-Latino hate crimes are on the rise. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush continues to insist Iran threatens the United States despite the new national intelligence estimate refuting most of his key claims. This week's consensus report from all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies concludes Iran shut down its nuclear weapons program more than 4 years ago. In his first public comments, President Bush said his position is unchanged.
I believe before the NIE that Iran was dangerous, and I believe after the NIE that Iran is dangerous. And I believe now is the time for the world to do the hard work necessary to convince the Iranians there is a better way forward.
President Bush was also asked if he was aware of the assessment when he warned of World War III less than 2 months ago. Bush admitted he was first informed of new information in August, but says he didn't find out the specifics until last week. Democratic Senator Joseph Biden responded, quote, if that's true, he has the most incompetent staff in modern American history. Meanwhile, in Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad went on state television today to hail what he called a national victory.
Yesterday's report was apparently for solving the problems of America's government and for dealing with the deadline it was confronted with. But in fact, it was the announcement of the victory for the Iranian nation in the nuclear issue against all international powers.
The Bush administration's also insisting the intelligence estimate will not change its determination to build a missile system in Europe. The White House claims the missile shield would serve as a defense against Iran, but it's widely seen as a first strike option. More on the Iran intelligence estimate after headlines. The Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case challenging the Bush administration's jailing of hundreds of Guantanamo prisoners without trial. Lawyers for the prisoners will argue the denial of habeas corpus violates the Constitution and international law. All of Guantanamo's estimated 305 prisoners were seized abroad. It's the third time the Supreme Court will consider a challenge to Guantanamo imprisonments since 2004. Newly revealed documents show the U.S. held a German prisoner at Guantanamo Bay despite privately acknowledging his innocence just months after his capture. Murat Kumaz was kidnapped and handed over to U.S. forces in Pakistan in December 2001. 4 weeks later, he became one of the first prisoners to arrive at Guantanamo, where he would spend the next 4 years. Declassified documents show U.S. and German intelligence officials concluded he had no links to terrorism as early as September 2002. A newly formed military tribunal finally took up his case in 2004, but the panel ignored the intelligence estimates and twice ordered his ongoing imprisonment. During this time, Kumaz says he suffered severe torture. He says he was beaten, given electric shocks, submerged in water, starved, and chained to a ceiling for days. Kumaz says he saw several people die and often thought he would die himself. He was finally released in August 2006, nearly 5 years after his capture. in Iraq. The Pentagon and U.S. Embassy are said to have reached a deal governing the activities of Blackwater and other private military firms. According to the New York Times, the agreement focuses on boosting security coordination with military command and providing further guidelines on when private guards can open fire. But the agreement takes no steps to address whether private military contractors can be held accountable for their actions. Government officials remain mute on whether Blackwater and other private military contractors can be prosecuted for shootings, such as the September killing of 17 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad. Contractors are currently immune from Iraqi courts under a U.S.-imposed law. Meanwhile, after initially indicating it would allow Blackwater's contract to expire in May, State Department officials are now raising the likelihood of a renewal. The acting head of U.S. diplomatic security, Gregory Starr, has reportedly told Blackwater it'll be judged on its actions from here on out. That would preclude the September mass killings from consideration when the State Department makes its decision. Relatives of Colombian hostages are in Venezuela today to seek the ongoing involvement of President Hugo Chavez in securing their release. The former presidential candidate, Ingrid Betancourt, and more than a dozen others have been held by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia since 2002. Colombian President Álvaro Uribe suspended Chavez's mediation last month after accusing him of improperly contacting the military. Chavez has denied the charges. On Tuesday, Betancourt's mother, Yolanda Pulecio, criticized Uribe.
I came to thank President Chavez and Senator Piedad Córdoba for all the efforts they've made. I'm very hurt over the very abrupt and very rude way in which President Uribe clogged everything up. But it's not the first time he's clogged everything up.
Meanwhile, Chavez is dealing with the aftermath of his slim defeat in Sunday's constitutional referendum. Voters narrowly rejected a series of proposals, including an end to presidential term limits and an increase in executive authority. Others included reducing the workday to 6 hours, creating a new pension fund for informal workers, and empowering community councils. In Bolivia, President Evo Morales praised Chavez's vow to respect the voters' choice.
I respect and value Chavez very much. He's democratic. If he were authoritarian, he would impose what he thinks to govern. But his desire is to consider the Venezuelan people, and Venezuelan people make democratic decisions. That must be respected, and here we don't have to be afraid of a referendum. The people can decide the fate of the country.
Meanwhile, in Washington, President Bush hailed the referendum results and said it should encourage Congress to pass a trade deal with Colombia.
I understand what you're saying about when you were informed about the NIE. Are you saying at no point, while the rhetoric was escalating, as World War III was making it into conversation?
The trade deal has been held up amidst concerns over Colombia's record on human rights. But Bush scored a victory on Tuesday when the Senate overwhelmingly approved a new trade deal with Peru. The final vote was 77 to 18. Republican Senator Kit Bond of Missouri said the pact would help counter the influence of leaders like Hugo Chavez.
We have an opportunity to establish good working relationships with Peru, with Colombia, with Panama, to show the leaders of the opposition in Venezuela that there's a better way than Hugo Chavez and his blind adherence to the Castro model in Cuba.
The House okayed its version of the Peru deal last month. Amazon Watch says the agreement will grant new rights for oil companies to drill in the Peruvian Amazon, benefiting U.S. corporations, including Hunt Oil, ConocoPhillips, Occidental Petroleum, and Newmont Mining. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice continues a foreign trip with a stop in Ethiopia today. Rice's visit comes as Ethiopia's U.S.-backed military intervention in Somalia draws growing scrutiny. The U.N. estimates some 215,000 people have fled their homes in fighting over the past 6 weeks. On Tuesday, U.N. Emergency Relief Coordinator John Holmes appealed for increased international aid.
The situation is obviously serious. Any place where you've got tens of thousands of people living in very, very makeshift huts in the open is obviously a very serious situation and one that's very worrying. And you know, one wonders how long they're going to have to be there because the violence in Mogadishu is still continuing.
Israel has announced plans to build more than 300 homes in a Jewish-only settlement in East Jerusalem. The new homes would be built in Har Homa, a settlement of more than 200,000 people occupied since 1967. Palestinians have called for sovereignty over East Jerusalem as part of a final peace deal. The move comes just 1 week after Israel made the latest of several pledges to freeze settlement construction at the U.S. brokered summit in Annapolis. But on Tuesday, Israeli officials said the roadmap does not apply to Jerusalem, but only to the West Bank. In a letter of protest, the Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat called the settlements the single greatest threat to a final peace deal. Meanwhile, a new study shows the Israeli government has carried out just 3% of its pledges to demolish unauthorized buildings in West Bank settlements over the last decade. The Israeli group Peace Now says the Israeli military conducted over 107 of more than 3,400 demolition orders. By contrast, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition says Israel has destroyed well over 5,000 Palestinian homes since the outbreak of the Second Intifada 7 years ago. Israeli courts have deemed the outposts illegal, while the World Court has ruled the entire settlements are illegal themselves. In South Africa, nearly 250,000 miners took to the streets of Johannesburg Tuesday in a one-day strike calling for better safety conditions and fair wages. Mine worker union president Senzeni Zakwana said the mining industry has failed its employees.
She believed that the mines had done enough to save the lives of mine workers. We believe that if employers would make sure that workers participate in deciding what kind of support is used underground, workers are given more power, that employers respect our members and treat them like human beings, this situation can change.
An average of 200 miners have died in South Africa's mines over the past 3 years. In Pakistan, two American peace activists have been arrested and apparently deported. Medea Benjamin and Teague Barry of the anti-war group Code Pink were detained as they headed to a student rally against the ongoing emergency rule. In Indonesia, the International Environmental Summit in Bali heard pleas Tuesday from communities affected or threatened by catastrophe caused by global warming. Speakers, including farmers, activists, and aid workers, called for a vast increase in international funding to offset the impact of rising seas, droughts, and other impacts. The Adaptation Fund has drawn contributions of just $67 million. Meanwhile, Australia's ratification of the Kyoto Protocol drew widespread praise, but questions about the country's reliance on coal. Shane Rottenbury of Greenpeace International said Australia will need to make drastic changes as the world's biggest coal exporter.
It should have happened much sooner, but it's good news, especially here at these climate negotiations, that Australia will now be a positive player rather than a wrecker when it comes to the Kyoto Protocol. That said, Australia still has a great challenge. As the world's biggest coal exporter, or as an enormous coal exporter, Australia has to really ask itself a question. Is it going to get serious and deal with climate change? Or is it going to keep exporting coal and simply fuel the problem and make it worse?
With Australia signing, the U.S. is now the only developed nation not to have ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Back in the United States, Republican presidential hopeful Rudolph Giuliani has resigned as head of his consulting firm, Giuliani Partners. For months, Giuliani has resisted calls to disclose his role in the firm and the clients he's represented. And back on Capitol Hill, credit card executives were called to testify Tuesday on an increasingly criticized practice of using questionable credit scores to raise customers' interest rates. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee is considering introducing legislation that would force credit card companies to honor their advertised rates. The committee also heard testimony from Americans charged exorbitant rates without their knowledge or consent. Tens of thousands of credit card holders have been forced to pay higher rates when their so-called FICO scores decline. Critics say the scores are lowered arbitrarily, often against customers that pay their bills regularly and promptly. Credit card debt in the United States is currently estimated at some $900 billion. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush says Iran remains a threat, despite a new national intelligence estimate that concluded Iran shut down its nuclear weapons program more than 4 years ago.
I believe before the NIE that Iran was dangerous, and I believe after the NIE that Iran is dangerous. And I believe now is the time for the world to do the hard work necessary to convince the Iranians there is a better way forward.
The NIE is a consensus assessment from all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. It starkly contradicts the Bush administration's repeated claims Iran is actively pursuing a nuclear bomb. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley announced the findings in Washington on Monday.
The intelligence community has high confidence that Iran halted its covert nuclear weapons program in the fall of 2003, and they have moderate confidence that it had not restarted that program as of mid-2007.
The NIE goes on to conclude spy agencies do not know whether Iran intends to develop nuclear weapons. It effectively rejects a national intelligence estimate 2 years ago that claimed Iran was pursuing a nuclear bomb through a secret program. The estimate also stands in stark contrast to recent language from President Bush, who warned as recently as October of a World War III if Iran continued with alleged nuclear activities. At Tuesday's news conference, Bush was asked by a reporter whether he was ever asked by his intelligence team to scale back his claims.
I understand what you're saying about when you were informed about the NIE. Are you saying at no point, while the rhetoric was escalating, as World War III was making it into conversation, at no point nobody from your intelligence team or your administration was saying, maybe you want to back it down a little bit?
No, I've never, nobody ever told me that. Having said, having laid that out, I still feel strongly that Iran's a danger. Nothing's changed in this NIE that says, okay, why don't we just stop worrying about it? Quite the contrary. I think the NIE makes it clear that Iran needs to be taken seriously as a threat to peace. My opinion hasn't changed. I just explained, Jim, that if you want to avoid a really problematic situation in the Middle East, now's the time to continue to work together. That's our message to our allies, and it's an important message for them to hear.
According to the Washington Post, intelligence officials began briefing senior members of the Bush administration on parts of the new NIE as early as July. Gareth Porter is an investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy. In October, he broke the story that the NIE on Iran had been held up for more than a year as part of an effort by Vice President Dick Cheney. Gareth Porter joins me now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
So explain what you understand the Bush administration understood.
Well, I think it's clear that the intelligence community had found something very different with regard to the Iranian nuclear program much earlier than this fall. It's very clear that it was at least last spring when they began to work on a very different conclusion about an Iranian nuclear weapons program. Which said that Iran had in fact given that idea up, and it's not clear actually whether this conclusion was being developed in fact in some form the previous fall. My story, based on a couple of sources who were in touch with people participating in the NIE process, said that the NIE had in fact been prepared. The NIE on Iran had been prepared as of last fall, was ready to be published, and was held up by the White House for political reasons. That is to say, it was not regarded as acceptable, and they wanted them to continue working on it. Now, some of that may well have been, at some point during 2007, that there was new information coming in which caused the intelligence community to say, well, let's strengthen the finding, let's strengthen our conclusions further. But it's very clear that a large part of the holdup in this NIE process was indeed the White House, and certainly it was Dick Cheney personally who was intervening in this, saying that we want you to go back to the drawing board and look at this again, because we don't think that your conclusion that Iran gave up a nuclear weaponization program makes sense.
Let's see, early November 2006, was that right before the 2006 elections?
Well, it was, as I understand it, it was prepared, it was ready to go before the elections, yes.
And that Dick Cheney had held it up?
Yes, indeed. And then, even after the elections, I think Cheney still wanted them to work on it further. And we don't know exactly what pressures were placed on the intelligence community, but we do know that Dick Cheney has, in the past, made visits to the CIA repeatedly to talk to analysts, has asked them to review their findings, and said, you know, that these findings he believes are not correct. So, you know, there's every reason to believe that Cheney was intervening actively in the process. And another piece of evidence to that effect, reported in the Washington Post yesterday, is that one of the arguments, perhaps the most important argument being made by the White House in regard to the finding about Iran's nuclear program that was being put forward by the intelligence community last spring and summer, was that this might well be a deception campaign by Iran. And that was supposedly being applied even to communications intercepts. The argument was still being made by presumably Cheney and his staff that the evidence that they were gathering reflected an Iranian deception campaign. Now, interestingly, that is the same argument that was used by the neoconservatives in the Bush administration in 2001 to try to refute the evidence being presented to the White House by George Tenet, then CIA director, that al-Qaeda was indeed a very serious threat and that they were getting indications that there could be an attack on the U.S. homeland by the summer of 2001. The neoconservatives, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, were arguing that this could be a deception campaign by al-Qaeda, and therefore we should not accept that as a legitimate reading of the al-Qaeda threat.
What do you make of, well, among others, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley arguing it suggests the president has had the right strategy, intensified international pressure along with a willingness to negotiate a solution?
Well, this is very interesting. You know, Hadley was able to cite some language in the NIE key findings that were published on Monday, which referred to international pressure. And I think there's every reason to believe that there was pressure put on the intelligence community to include some language in there suggesting that. But in any case, if you read very carefully the full text of the paragraph in which that reference to international appears, it is a reference to what was happening in the fall of 2003. And what is most interesting about that paragraph is that it suggests that there was, in fact, a process within the Iranian regime of making a important choice of strategy on what to do about its nuclear program. There was, we know from a speech given by the senior advisor to the National Security Council of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, in fall of 2004, that there were very serious debates within the Iranian leadership during the fall of 2003 in which the most conservative elements were arguing that they should not agree with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, on an additional protocol which would involve more stringent international inspection of their nuclear sites. And they should not negotiate with the European three, Britain, France, and Germany, on a possible agreement that could result in a prolonged suspension of their uranium enrichment program. But the moderates in the national security elite of Iran and the leadership decided instead to go with a more open approach to their nuclear program. They decided to agree to carry out an additional protocol and to begin ratification of it. And they agreed to negotiate with the European three on a new agreement, which could result in a permanent suspension of the uranium enrichment, but also would involve serious negotiation on Iran's security interests and political interests in the Middle East. So this represented a fundamental shift in Iranian policy toward their nuclear program. And there's every reason to believe that whatever was involved in this dropping of certain programs, it was part of a much broader shift which involved openness and the desire to reach an agreement with the Europeans and, I think, indirectly with the United States. So I think the real lesson of which the NIE reflects about Iranian policy is that they were indeed serious about making this shift. They were telling the truth, in fact, about their policy from fall 2003 on.
Now, what about the director of national intelligence of Michael McConnell? Bush saying this in the news conference yesterday, that he told him in the summer, in July, that he had some new information, but not being briefed until last week. The question of why President Bush wouldn't press him further, considering he was talking about war with Iran. How credible is it that Bush only knew last week, despite the fact that McConnell had alerted him as early as July?
I think that's absolutely incredible. And certainly, we cannot have any doubt at all that Dick Cheney was fully briefed, fully informed on the progress of the NIE at every stage. We know that Cheney's staff is constantly keeping in touch with the intelligence community, following the current progress on the NIE, whatever it might be at that stage, and indeed trying to influence it. So the only question really is whether Cheney tried to keep Bush in the dark. That is conceivable, but certainly not very likely.
Can you tell us about Fallon?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that that Admiral William Fallon, the commander of CENTCOM, has played an active role within the administration in trying to push back on the Cheney policy of trying to ramp up the tensions with Iran and looking for an opportunity, frankly, for a potential use of force against the Iranian regime. Fallon has made it clear privately as early as last February, at the time that he was having his confirmation hearings in the Senate, that there would be no war against Iran on his watch as CENTCOM commander, and he indicated privately again to one of my sources that he was working with others in the military leadership to make sure that that didn't happen. There's evidence that Fallon has pushed back on Iraq as best he could to try to limit the surge, to try to move faster on troop withdrawal, and there's no question that he has opposed the use of military force. For example, an interview with Al Jazeera, which I understand he personally asked for. He approached Al Jazeera himself and asked to be interviewed so that he could make a statement that the talk about war, which had been coming from, of course, Cheney and the White House, was not useful. So there's very little reason to doubt that that Admiral Fallon has been playing a role behind the scenes in trying to work against the Cheney strategy on Iran.
Gareth Porter, I want to thank you for being with us, an investigative historian and journalist. He writes on the Huffington Post, a blog, and often writes for Interpress Service. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk about a massacre that took place in India 5.5 years ago. There is new information. Stay with us. Tommaso Haddad and Sarah Morris singing Sad Soul here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An explosive report by the Indian magazine Tehelka reveals new information about those responsible for the massacre of 2,500 Muslims in the western Indian state of Gujarat in March of 2002. The brutal violence against Muslims took place over a span of 3 days, followed an attack on a train carrying right-wing Hindu activists. 58 people on the train were burnt to death when it stopped in the town of Godhra. Mainstream analyses have explained the statewide violence against Muslims as a, quote, spontaneous reaction to the attack on the train. However, Tehelka's extensive exposé challenges this understanding of what happened in Gujarat 5.5 years ago and demonstrates that the anti-Muslim violence was highly organized and premeditated. The exposé was published in late October after a reporter infiltrated a right-wing Hindu organization for 6 months. It includes spy cam video footage of Hindu activists bragging about killing Muslims and detailing the support they receive from the highest levels of the state government. With state elections in Gujarat beginning next week, the expose could have a significant political impact. Narendra Modi, who was chief minister during the 2002 massacre, never lost his position. He remains one of the leading contenders. Modi is from the BJP, which is tied to a network of right-wing Hindu organizations. Many of the activists interviewed by Tehelka say the anti-Muslim violence could not have happened without Modi's tacit support. Harsh Bhat is a BJP member of the Gujarat State Assembly from Godhra. He said Narendra Modi gave Hindu right-wing activists 3 days to act with impunity.
He had given us 3 days to do whatever we could. He said he would not give us time after that. He said this openly. After 3 days, he asked us to stop, and everything came to a halt. It stopped after 3 days. Even the army was called in. All the forces came, and we had 3 days, and did what we had to do in those 3 days. Yes, he did what no other chief minister could have done.
An excerpt from Tehelka's spy cam videos implicating the Gujarat chief minister, the equivalent of governor, Narendra Modi. We go now to Tarun Tejpal. I interviewed him earlier this week and began by asking him to lay out the sequence of events that took place in Gujarat 5.5 years ago.
Well, what had happened was that in 2002, in what remains probably the most outrageous act of religious violence, aided and abetted by the state, Hindu mobs, which were then designated as Hindu mobs, but now seems increasingly were cadre workers of Hindu right-wing parties, they assaulted and massacred, killed, raped more than 2,000 Muslims, unarmed, innocent Muslims. And for 5 years, there's the whole version of what happened has been contested. I mean, there's been the version of the victims, there's been a version of the state, there's been a version of the police, a version of civil rights groups, but there's been virtually no justice or any remorse shown for what happened. What the Tehelka investigation, I think, brought forward was, for the first time in 5 years, the version of the men who actually committed the crimes. I mean, what the Tehelka reporter managed to do was get from the horse's mouth exactly how these mass murderers killed, who they killed, how they killed, on whose orders they killed. And then, not just that, how the entire process of justice was subverted after the massacres were over, and how many of these men have then been protected by the state.
How has it been that it's taken 5.5 years to expose what took place?
Well, you know, Amy, in India, this is not uncommon. We have some sort of amnesia about these carnages and these riots and these massacres that take place periodically. There's religious violence, but there's also very often caste violence and class violence. And we are amnesiac about how we deal, you know, with these things. For example, if you remember, there were the 1984 riots against the Sikhs in Delhi by Hindu mobs after the assassination of Indira Gandhi. And more than 3,000 Sikhs were killed in 1984. And even today, 23 years later, only 3 people have been convicted for the killing of more than 3,000 Sikhs. So it's not uncommon that for 5 years, the Gujarat case has not come to a head. And as I said, you know, the way it's dealt with in India normally is that charges and countercharges begin to fly. There's a whole miasma of contested versions that's created in the public space. And the hope is that very soon a new tragedy will overstep the old one, and public memory will actually just let it slide, and things will go on. And mostly it does happen like this. Just that in the case of Gujarat, it seemed the kind of schism that was actually going to hurt the very idea of India, the very idea of this great plural modern nation. And so civil rights activists in particular and ordinary citizens have kept the issue alive, but did not receive the kind of shot in the arm for their work till Tehelka broke this story, giving a shot in the arm. In all this, of course, let me just add that the central government, the Congress government, which reigns at the center, continues to behave in a reasonably shabby and shameful way.
Tarun Tejpal, explain the chain of command. Lay out for us exactly how it happened in March of 2002, how these events unfolded to this mass murder of more than 2,500 Muslims.
Well, you know, two things happened at that point. First, on the 26th of February, a train carrying a bogie full of Hindu right-wing activists was attacked by a Muslim mob near Godhra. Now, this Godhra incident has, for a long time, the train incident, the killing of these 59 Hindu pilgrims, has become a point of defense for the right-wing Hindu organizations, who say that that's what sparked the riots, which they claim were spontaneous. Now, the Tehelka investigation reveals that contrary to what Narendra Modi has been saying, the Godhra incident was a spontaneous incident, not a conspiracy or a pre-planned massacre, whereas what followed was a planned massacre and not a conspiracy. I mean, it's just exactly the opposite way. I mean, our investigation reveals that what seems to have happened is that on the railway station at Godhra, there was an altercation between the pilgrims and Muslim hawkers who were selling their wares on the platform. And there was, it seems, an attempt to abduct a young Muslim girl by these pilgrims in the course of that altercation. Then when the train leaves the station, it seems somebody pulls the chain to stop the train, and Muslim mobs from the adjoining slums arrive in large numbers and attack that particular bogie. And in the course of this entire assault, the bogie gets burnt down, tragically killing these 59 pilgrims. What follows then is, as you just read out, the MLA of Godhra telling you, the elected legislator, it seems Modi gives his Hindu organizations and the mobs 3 days to get even. So the state sanctions 3 days of violence against Muslims. And in those 3 days, I mean, the police looks the other way, and these organizations, as is detailed extensively in our investigation, go ahead and massacre more than 2,000 Muslims. Women are raped, children are killed, groups of families are burnt. 3 days later, it does come to a stop, but by then, more than 2,000 people are dead. And the police collusion, by the way, has also been fairly established by the Tehelka investigation.
I want to play a clip that was secretly recorded. This is of Babu Patel, leader of the Bajrang Dal, the militant youth wing of the network of Hindu right-wing organizations. He was imprisoned for his role in the killing of Muslims, but was released on bail 8 months later. When Tehelka spoke to him in September, he bragged about one of the most infamous incidents during the 2002 violence in Gujarat, slitting open the womb of a pregnant Muslim woman and pulling out the fetus.
It has been written in my FIR, there was this pregnant woman, I slit her open, sister effer, showed them what kind of revenge we can take if our people are killed. I am not a feeble vegetarian. We didn't spare anyone. They shouldn't even be allowed to breed. I say that even today, whoever they are, women, children, whoever. Nothing to be done to them but cut them down, thrash them, slash them, burn the bastards.
That was Babu Patel. Explain the significance of this group and how it ties up into the power structure.
See, Babu Bajrangi is today one of the founts of sort of bigotry in that part of Gujarat. I mean, he represented at that point extreme right-wing grouping called the Bajrang Dal, which is associated with the mainline right-wing party, the BJP. And this man has been obviously deranged by the kind of poisonous ideology, the communal ideology that's fostered by the right-wingers. And you can see the man has no remorse. For us at Tehelka, the most frightening thing about the whole investigation was that not a single person, not a single one of the mass murderers exhibited any remorse. Now, Babu Bajrangi's case is very interesting because in other portions of the tapes on Babu Bajrangi, he talks about what happened after all this was done. He tells us that the Home Minister of Gujarat asked him to leave the state. So Babu Bajrangi, after all the mass murders, called up the Home Minister of Gujarat, who said, leave the state. Now, the Home Minister in India is responsible for maintaining law and order in the state. So the Home Minister says, leave the state, Babu. Then the state actually gives this man shelter in another part of India. When the heat gets too much in Ahmedabad, in Gujarat, because of civil rights noises and media noises, they stage an arrest for Babu Bajrangi and bring him back to Ahmedabad and stage an arrest. This is information being given to us by Babu Bajrangi, the Babu Patel. He's giving us this information. Then he says the case goes to court. When it goes to court, the magistrate says, in Babu's own words, the magistrate says, you are such a evil man that you should be hanged, not once, but 10 times. So what happens? So Babu Bajrangi then tells us that particular case, the magistrate is transferred out. A second magistrate comes in. The second magistrate says almost the same thing, that you are such an incredibly evil man, you should be hanged not once but 10 times. So this is Babu telling us the story. The second magistrate is also moved out. A third magistrate is brought in. In the meantime, he also tells us that Modi is assuring him not to worry, things will be taken care of. So a new magistrate is brought in, and then Babu tells us on camera, he says, I am given bail, and so is everybody else. We are all freed up. So this is the kind of incredible subversion of justice that is seen even after the killings.
So, Tarun Tejpal, can you talk about the significance of who Modi is, equivalent to a governor, and he's running again for the governor of Gujarat. Is that right?
Well, Narendra Modi is a national level leader of the BJP, which is the right wing Hindu political sort of umbrella party. And Narendra Modi was sent into Gujarat just a year before the Godhra incident and the Gujarat riots took place. And Modi was sent there to stop the slide of a BJP of the BJP's political fortunes because they were on the decline, and the general understanding was that the BJP would lose this election. And then Narendra Modi comes in, the Godhra incident takes place, the riots take place, the Hindu vote, which is by now very polarized, consolidates behind Modi, and Modi has a landslide victory. And Modi then becomes the chief minister, which is the equivalent of a governor in America, of Gujarat, which is a very prosperous state. And Gujaratis, by the way, are one of India's greatest diasporas. I mean, they're around the world, they're all over America, and they're a very strongly business and mercantile community, known for their ability to make money, to run very efficient businesses. And so Modi has, for the last 5 years, reigned in Gujarat as a sort of the upholder of macho Hinduism, of aggressive Hinduism. And for everybody on the secular end of the spectrum, he remains the most hated figure in India because they see in him an embodiment of everything that can go wrong with the great Indian democratic experiment if it begins to turn religious and communal.
Now, Modi was supposed to come here and speak in the United States in 2005, but the U.S. denied him the visa he required to come in. Report of the immigration rules around being responsible for serious human rights violations.
Well, I think that was a great victory for all the secular fronts and secular forces that are trying to fight this kind of religious virus, which is growing in India. I think it was a great victory because it was an international snub. Though in India we have not been able to defeat him electorally, or the people have not defeated him electorally so far, at least this was a clear international snub that you will not be able to get away continually with the kind of record of human rights violations that you carry.
Tarun Tejpal, you're the editor of this independent weekly, Tehelka. What has been the significance, the impact of your magazine doing this exposé, not only the most important story of our time, the headline on the front page, The Truth, Gujarat 2002, and the words of the men who did it, but also the one that followed, India Writes Back, An Avalanche of Hope and Despair.
Well, I think the second one, the second cover pretty much says it, An Avalanche of Hope and Despair. You know, I mean, both things were seen after we broke this story. The first thing it did was it gave an incredible shot in the arm to civil rights groups and civil rights warriors and civil rights activists, because in India today, most of the big battles for the soul of India, for modernity, for democracy, for secularism, are not being fought by political parties, but are being fought by civil rights warriors who are very strongly still aligned to the founding vision of India. The despair had a lot to do with the fact that people expected the national government, the Congress government at the center in Delhi, to act with some amount of political will and political vision. And nothing of that has been seen in the last 6 weeks. I mean, the despair actually carries on. The fact that such testimony, such graphic testimony, has been brought into the public space. I mean, this is probably the first time in the history of the media that you have mass murderers live telling you about how they killed and why they killed and who asked them to kill. And despite that, the center, that is the Congress government at the center in Delhi, has found itself unable to move and act. Most lawyers, most people in India think that the central government should have imposed a president's rule, which in India is the equivalent of a central rule, in the state of Gujarat, moved in and removed the state government of Modi, and insisted that fast-track justice be done on the entire series of cases that have been pending for the last 5 years. Unfortunately, none of this has happened, and that's disappointed a lot of people. Elections are due in Gujarat in a week from now, and everyone feels today that the Congress's inaction has to do largely with its need to make vote calculations and electoral calculations, and that again is disappointing, because one of the reasons for the continuing slide of public property, public discourse in India is the fact that everything today is only weighed in vote terms, in electoral terms.
Tarun Tejpal is the editor-in-chief of the magazine Tehelka, which just came out with this expose on what happened in Gujarat 5.5 years ago, the slaying of 2,500 Muslims. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll link to Tehelka.org on our website. When we come back, we go to Montgomery, Alabama, to the Southern Poverty Law Center to find out about new statistics suggesting a rise in anti-Latino hate crimes. Stay with us. Meditation by Ravi Shankar here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New FBI statistics suggest anti-Latino hate crimes have risen by almost 35% since 2003. In California, the state with the largest number of Latinos, the number of hate crimes against Latinos have almost doubled. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, the violence engulfing Latinos is part of a backlash over the immigration debate in this country. For years, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking examples of physical and psychological violence waged against Latinos. Mark Potok joins us now from Montgomery, Alabama, editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly intelligence report, which monitors hate groups in the U.S. Thanks for joining us, Mark. What have you found?
Thanks for having me, Amy. Well, basically, it's an anecdotal report. The FBI statistics, like all hate crime statistics, are extremely shaky, but the direction that things are going in is obvious. I mean, what we did was essentially compile a list of horrors. Stories about, you know, a teenager in Houston being sodomized with an umbrella patio pole in an anti-immigrant attack. You know, a kid attacked at a fair by the Klan in Kentucky. You know, another teenager, Latino teen, chased around a room in Long Island by neo-Nazis with a running chainsaw, saying, you know, this is how you run for the border. And these crimes also include a great many people who aren't affiliated with any kind of hate group or anything like that. So really, the point of our report, really the cover story in our forthcoming intelligence report, is that the country seems to be awash in these kinds of crimes. And I would say beyond that, that, you know, these crimes, I think, are clearly the outcome of the kind of rancid political debate that you've been talking about on your show. And in fact, we're talking about Lou Dobbs yesterday.
Well, I actually wanted to turn to an excerpt of the conversation that we had yesterday with CNN anchor Lou Dobbs. During yesterday's broadcast, we played this report from Lou Dobbs' show, Lou Dobbs Tonight, about former Mexican President Vicente Fox's May 2006 visit to the United States.
This Mexican military incursion was fully authorized. A Mexican Air Force jet carrying President Vicente Fox, who was not just invited to Utah, but encouraged to visit by Governor John Huntsman.
We fully support the businessmen from Utah and Mexico.
It's estimated Utah has about 100,000 illegal aliens, and the number is growing rapidly. Utah is also part of the territory some militant Latino activists refer to as Aztlan, the portion of the southwest United States they claim rightfully belongs to Mexico. You could call this the Vicente Fox Aztlan tour, since the three states he'll visit, Utah, Washington, and California, are all part of some radical group's vision of the mythical indigenous homeland. Lou?
Casey, thank you very much.
After we played this clip for Lou Dobbs, we pointed out the Southern Poverty Law Center criticized CNN for airing that report in part because it featured a map of the United States highlighting the seven southwestern states that Mexico supposedly covets and calls Aztlan. The map was prominently sourced to the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is considered by many to be a white supremacist hate group. We asked Lou Dobbs for his response.
I mean, we weren't hiding anything. We had no idea what they were. The field producer who used it went on this web, did a grab, as it's called, and put it up. And she was suspended for a day for doing so. Did you guys know that we have sent our producers and our reporters down to the Southern Poverty Law Center years ago to make certain this sort of thing doesn't happen? That's how seriously we take the issue. And for you to talk about the incursion, you forgot to point out that that was coming out a rather jocular discussion of the incursions by Mexican forces along the border and the response of the U.S. government. But are you
Lou,
offended?
Did you say you have no idea what the Council on Conservative Citizens is?
Did I say I don't?
Yes.
I certainly do now. Absolutely. What did I say? You didn't hear what I just said?
I just
They're acknowledged as a hate group. Absolutely.
So, but the problem is this.
What is the problem here?
Projecting the image to your viewers that there's a Mexican desire to reconquer the reconquista of the southwestern United States does create images, and especially in people who are not necessarily as intelligent as you necessarily, well, have studied as much as you have, you know, that the country is under siege.
Are you so self-important that you don't think people have a sense of humor when Casey Wyand says this is an authorized incursion by the Mexican government? You don't think people have a sense of humor about that? The reality is, I think most people do. The other thing is, who are you trying to protect America from? I'm a little confused, because the reality is that there is a strong radical group of reconquistas and Aztlan aficionados, and I have had them demonstrating against me in a couple of cities over the past few weeks. Don't sit here being disingenuous and sanctimonious, because let me tell you something.
I'm not.
There
being
is many idiots on either extreme of this debate, and don't kid yourself.
But Lou, I think what's important here once again is the pattern. It's the pattern.
The pattern is, for 5 years we've been reporting on illegal immigration. The pattern is that we have been reporting on the impact of illegal immigration. It doesn't suit your partisan views, and that's understandable, or your ideological views. But don't get carried away with yourselves, for crying out loud.
Okay, Lou, let's talk about some of the guests you've had on your show.
Sure.
For example, Barbara Koh, leader of the California Coalition for Immigration Reform.
She's not a guest. You're reading from the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Just
one
second.
She was not a guest.
I am going to look at the, as you said, you actually felt that the Southern Poverty Law Center was so important in getting information that you sent your producers down there to get information so that you wouldn't represent
hate groups
on the air.
They're nothing but a fundraising organization, and they're indulging in pure BS, and so are you when you quote them.
That was Lou Dobbs on our broadcast yesterday. Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, your response.
Well, I mean, I guess I find it amusing that Lou first cites us as an authority to show that he looks into the allegations of racism seriously, and then says we're nothing but a fundraising operation that cranks out a lot of BS, as he says. He's also called us on the air a fascist organization for what we've said about this. Look, I mean, the real point is the point you made. This is a part of a pattern. It's not that his producer happened to accidentally grab this particular graphic. It's what that represents, that Dobbs is really pushing these completely bogus ideas, racist conspiracy theories. It's worth saying that in addition to the Reconquista theory, the Aztlan theory, he has pushed very heavily the idea that there is a North American Union, an entity which is planned by Bush and other neoconservatives, which would merge the countries of Canada, Mexico, and the United States. He has pushed this on his website with polls asking people, are they concerned? He's mentioned it repeatedly on the air. At this point, 18 state legislatures have passed resolutions condemning the so-called North American Union. One small problem, there is no such thing. This is a figment of the imaginations of people on the radical right. The theory essentially comes from the John Birch Society and related kinds of organizations. You know, it's utterly bogus. But it's the same idea as the Aztlan theory. The Mexicans, the Canadians, in this case, are out to do us in.
And how the Minutemen tie into this, if they do, Mark Potok?
Well, the Minutemen, in a lot of ways, and the vigilante groups in general, have been transmitters of theories like this. You know, the Aztlan theory, for instance, was pushed very heavily early on by a hate group called American Border Patrol. This idea that Mexico and native-born Chicanos in the United States were involved together in this plot then made its way out into the Minutemen groups and eventually landed on Lou Dobbs on any number of AM radio shows. It's been talked about by U.S. congressmen. And so it's become a part of this debate. And yet it has nothing to do with what's actually going on. And this is really the point we've tried to make with Dobbs, is that, you know, you are not contributing in any way. You are detracting from any kind of democratic discussion of immigration. I think it's obvious that immigration is not only an issue, but a problem, something that must be dealt with. People in a democracy have every right to debate. But when the debate becomes about, you know, they are bringing leprosy, they are coming here to rape our children, they are destroying the economy, they're wrecking the culture, they're more loyal to the Catholic Church than they are to our government, and so on, one is poisoning the debate.
Mark Potok, I want to thank you for being with us, editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly intelligence report, which focuses on far-right hate groups in the United States. And that does it for our broadcast. Tonight I'll be in Washington, D.C. for the screening of a new documentary called USA versus Alarian at the AMC Lowe's Uptown Theater at 3426 Connecticut Avenue at 7 p.m. Afterwards, I'll moderate a panel on Alarian's case with law professors David Cole and Jonathan Turley, as well as Alarian's attorney, Linda Moreno, and Sami Alarian's son, Abdullah, and the director of the film. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduceo, Aaron Mattei, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.